Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. On behalf of our family of hosts, staff, and the millions of listeners who have tuned in since 2009, we want to wish you happy holidays and ask for your support as we launch our daily in-house news coverage. Please consider making us a part of your end-of-year giving in 2013. Your membership donation is tax-deductible and the best way to show you believe in our work and the importance of a free, food-focused media resource. Consider donating today at heritageradionetwork.org by clicking the Donate button. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I am your coughing host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, not always with cold, but every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about certainly my favorite subject, taste. And today, I'm so excited to have in the studio someone whose writing and research has informed the way that I myself think about taste and have over the years processed it as a cultural phenomenon. She herself is hacking from a cough. It's that time of year, I guess. That's how you know that we're live. Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson is a professor at Columbia University, a cultural sociologist, author of the book that really changed the way that I think about food called Accounting for Taste, Food and Media, I should say. I'm working on a new project called Word of Mouth. Welcome to the studio, Priscilla.
Well, thank you for having me, Mitchell. It's nice to be here.
It's so good to have you here. And this is a radio show about taste, and I think that you might be the most informed person to sit here and talk to me about that subject as someone who has looked at the cultural phenomenon not different from food, and I think that's an important part. We're talking about gastronomy, we're talking about cuisine, we're talking about the way that food becomes something much more than just the nutrients that nourish us. Tell me a little bit about your thinking.
It becomes much more than the nutrients because we talk about it, and that's the only way you can communicate food. You cannot eat someone else's food, is to talk about it. And so the range of food talk is extraordinary, and I include in that representations, images, movies, films, radio, television, all of which has exploded enormously in the past 20, 25 years.
Right. Exploded in the past 25 years, but a lot of your work in 18th century France, when we think of the quote-unquote birth of the modern restaurant or the concept of gastronomy in a Western sense, was the same thing going on then?
Oh, absolutely the same thing going on. And where the French had an edge is that they talk about food more than most people. Sometimes they won't shut up about it. So that reading prefaces to cookbooks, nobody can just write a cookbook. You have to write a preface and say the previous cookbook writer was lousy and I'm doing it better and this is what should be done. And so it becomes part of a polemical enterprise as well. And the French are very good with that. And then you add with the expansion of the publishing industry in the early 19th century with far more books being published and also a lot of engravings, images, and then reproductions later in the century. So all these different ways of essentially substituting for taste, since you can't taste it, you have to talk about it in as many imaginative ways as possible.
So what happens to food? What's the process of going from taste to talk, let's say, from the senses to the mind, perhaps? Like, why is that? What does that allow for in food that would not be possible
otherwise?
It
allows you to communicate and to connect with somebody else, to share that which is intensely private. What goes down your gullet doesn't go down somebody else's gullet. What is intensely private, and it pushes you to verbalize what it is about that experience that is so interesting. Now, one of the problems is that we have very small vocabulary for talking about food. In any sort of a specific sense. And so metaphors are like absolutely all over the place.
Right.
You can't live without a metaphor of one kind and another to
just
explain.
Out of curiosity, is that true in French too, or do they have more words because they've been talking about it for so long?
No, they're you know, wine criticism is probably the most extreme in these kinds of metaphorizations, but you see it in food criticism as well. I mean, how do you explain what's tremendous about the food in one of my favorite films, which is Ratatouille? If Remy the Rat, to explain what's new about something, to translate that, well, the Disney Pixar has to have exploding stars in the background, and has to have music that goes bing, 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 bing. And then at one point, Remy comes up with a thing saying this is new. Lightning is struck. Something is, it's lightning-y. Well, that's not...
Lightning-y. That's right. It's not a word, and it's almost a metaphor, maybe.
It's almost a metaphor, not a word, but there it is.
Right. And is that distinct from other sensory experiences? Is for some reason, maybe these are not your areas of expertise, but, you know, I think of art criticism, I think about thinking about music. Is there something that connects that's easier to discuss?
Well, if you're thinking about the eye or the ear, it's much easier to intellectualize. The eye and the ear, hearing and sight, have always since, I don't know, Plato, I guess, or Aristotle, been considered the higher senses, higher, closer to the brain, head, and so forth. Whereas taste, touch, and smell are all sort of nitty-gritty, down to the ground, messy, etc.
Right.
So there's always sort of a suspicion of taste that it's, you know, it's too close to us as animals. You know, our animal nature becomes a little bit obvious.
Right. And so does that individuality, you know, because as you say, the exact molecules or foods that go down one person's gullet do not go into another, but some way you can see something objective, or you can hear the same thing. You may not process it the same way, but the actual same sounds are being perceived. In this quest for vocabulary, one of the things that I find, we don't even have a word to call people who are interested in food that anyone likes. Foodie is the word that we have, and we all use it in quotes. We all roll our eyes as foodies when we say it. We try to distance ourselves. Gastronomy feels scientific. It doesn't really work for us or the gastronome.
It's hoity-toity.
It's hoity-toity. And in this talking, that distance we give by talking makes food seem hoity-toity sometimes. And we were just talking before we got on the air about food competitions and competitive eating, and how, you know, in some ways they are almost antithetical to the hoity-toityness of this food talk we have, and that's the role they play.
Very much so, that it's the food competition. First place, it's never about taste. No one ever tells you that the hot dogs are good hot dogs. I mean, that may be part of Nathan's advertising, but in terms of the competition, good hot dogs, bad hot dogs doesn't make any difference.
In some ways, if the food were good, that would be wasteful, or it's such a shame to eat it in that way, to not taste it, right?
As one of the top contender, top listed man now said, it's not about taste, it's not about food, it's about drive and determination. So he's completely trying to get rid of the whole notion of food there. It's his drive, determination to be number one.
Right. So, but how do we negotiate both in the language and in the experience of connoisseurship, another hoity-toity word, but one that I think is meaningful here, between a pleasure, let's say, that is shareable and one that is exclusive or elite?
Well, that is, I think, one of the problems of what I call culinary individualism, that it's not part of a social experience. I mean, if you consider, as I do, the basic enterprise of the meal, the basic institution of the meal. A meal is to create a community, maybe with only two people, but still creating a community. And you need a language to work that out. If you're just eating by yourself, you can write notes and whatnot. But
take pictures
and take
tweet
pictures
it, right?
And people do and tweet right. And so forth.
But that's, I myself am guilty of that, as people who listen, follow me know.
But as... you know, that those are also ways of reaching out to it, sort of making a meal,
right,
when in fact it is only a single person. That's, you know, end up people talking to the waiter or the host, whatever. So I think it's a, it's building a community through a shared meal. And from that, you articulate what is it about that meal that creates a good community or a bad community for that matter.
And do we, does that, how do I say this? You know, we are focused often on taste as that sensory experience. We talk about it to turn it into something bigger, more communal. And does the impact of what's happening around us, the environment, change that experience? Do we process it differently, or how do we negotiate the individual social thing in our own eating?
Well, we certainly process what we eat as a function of what we have eaten. So that we have no idea what, I don't know, camembert in the late 19th century tastes like, because we can't taste it with the taste buds of the late 19th century, even if the cheese was the same.
Right. I mean, it'd be well aged by now.
But we would be, you know, we've had hamburgers. That changes our taste. Whether or not you like McDonald's is irrelevant. They're part of your taste topography, I guess, is what I would call it. And so, therefore, it's even harder to connect with a sense of what's going on in the past. You can find plenty of stuff about the food, but what the taste is, then you're in very different territory.
So how do you do this kind of research then? I mean, the research that you do, I know you do all sorts of different things, but as a sociologist looking at these things, you know, it's not exactly counting people doing stuff. The cultural sociology is perhaps a little bit more abstract than that, but
it's I like what people say about what they're doing and what they're eating and what they're talking. I was just doing Remy and his brother about lightning. Well, that's the kind of thing. What are the ways in which we try to communicate more or less well? Excuse me.
So, I mean, as you mentioned, as it's hard to imagine sitting here at a radio station that's kind of 24/7 food, and next week's guest, Alan Salkin, has written History of the Food Network, and the last 20-25 years has been a real explosion of food talk, let's say, in the biggest sense. Forget even social media, which is the last 5 years, let's say. And what are the implications of such an explosion of this kind of talk? I mean, we're in a funny time where food's everywhere. Maybe people are cooking less. Last week's guest, Laura Shapiro, denies that. But something's going on. How does the talk go back to the food?
Well, people are certainly cooking differently. They're cooking, I think, probably more and more as a function of different kinds of food talk. That they hear, you hear something about something, you want to try it or try something else. So I think that all the talk about food, on the best scenario, it pushes you to try new things. On the worst case scenario, it's, well, this is too much, let me give up and just go have a hamburger. I mean, but the range of food worlds is really quite enormous.
But you think there is a connection, though, between the talk and the behavior. So one comes from a meeting and we're discussing, and the other comes from I've heard discussed and now I choose to eat. Because it's an issue that concerns a lot of people looking at public health issues, for instance. Mm-hmm. So here we have a culture of, or subculture, let's say, of eating competitions, and people are fascinated by that. And we also have an obesity epidemic. And so the notion of, let's just say, myself included, fat people cheering on people overstuffing themselves to cheers on television poses perhaps an ethical dilemma.
What is the role of food? And in competitive eating in particular, you can see the way competitive eating is presented as a sport, which tries to hide or obscure all the ethical questions, all the more so as the competitors are not themselves large,
right?
Particularly. I mean,
certainly not the Japanese contingent.
The Japanese and the number one woman, you know, she's 105 pounds or something like that. So.
But and then there's the weight. I mean, it really isn't. It's a bit of a microcosm of all of the food issues there in the competitive eating. The detachment of food from nutrition. There's a waste or sustainability issue. Mm-hmm. What is enough? There's a weight and public health thing. And then there are some successful celebrity skinny people who do it.
And there's also it's anti-meal. I mean, it is not a meal. You are just stuffing hot dogs or whatever. There's even a record for mayonnaise. Now, mayonnaise is not
mayonnaise
even a food. Mayonnaise
eating competition?
There's a mayonnaise record.
thinking of, we're gonna contemplate that and take a quick break. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm speaking with sociologist and professor at Columbia University, Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson. We are talking about taste, and in the meantime, we'll be coughing and sneezing during this musical interlude.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Oh, excuse me. We're back on the air. This is Mitchell Davis. I'm your host of Taste Matters, and I'm talking today with Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson, who is a cultural sociologist and professor at Columbia University, and her specialty is taste or taste talk, and that's something we do a lot of here. If you have any questions about taste talk or about competitive eating or about 18th or 19th century France and food, give us a call at 718-497-2128. You can also send us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you're listening to the podcast or you just prefer to communicate in 140 character snippets, tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. So we've talked about taste talk. What about taste writing? A lot of your work is sort of looking at the literary record of taste, and food has always had one of these challenges, not just in history, but as a cultural artifact, is that it is so ephemeral. We consume it, it disappears, it rots, it does all those sorts of things. And one of the records we have even longer than taste is writing about it. But the process of writing is different yet again, requires different cogitation from even just talking about it. How does writing and cookbooks and the explosion of books, not even about cooking, but about food in general, come into this conversation?
There are so many different genres of writing about food. A lot of my students come in and they say, oh, I want to be a food writer, but they haven't a clue really about what, in fact, they want to do. But, I mean, you just take the genre of cookbooks. Cookbooks have changed enormously over a couple of hundred years, but even in the past 50 years or so. So many of them are travel books. The persona of the cook writing it is it a friend and right. So forth. And one of the points I tend to think of for French cuisine, which was traditionally associated with essentially American elites, men's clubs and fancy hotels and so forth, not until it got translated into American terms by a cook, that is to say by a woman, with MFK Fisher, and then, of course, Julia Child, did it really become more than a fancy, as we said earlier, hoity-toity cuisine with no connections to us. So all of these books are missionary books in some ways.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they have a mission to change the way we think about taste and food. And you can look at someone like Daniel Boulud's new cookbook, same thing there. He wants to create an experience of French, of traditional French food, but it's not traditional French food that a lot of people would recognize. It's Daniel Boudou's take with vacuum-packed cooking sous vide and right. So forth. But it's all sort of a part of a mission to get people to taste the way you taste.
Obviously, you live in America, and you've studied and lived in France, and we often see ourselves in what we see in others. And I'm wondering, as America seems to have been awakening to the pleasures of food, the talk and taste of food, what's happening in France? Do you hear them disappearing? You hear, Spain or Denmark or whatever. What's going on there? Do they even know what's happening here in America? Do they care?
I don't think they know that much what's happening in America. The film Julie and Julia, mm-hmm. for example, the French went because of Meryl Streep, not because Julia Child meant anything.
Of course,
to them.
Right.
But where the French model may not be dominant, and it isn't dominant in the way that it was, say, even 50 years ago, but the French model of the importance of food talk, I think that may be the biggest contribution that French gastronomy, cooking, whatever, food has made. And that's not going to change because it's a model that other cuisines, other countries take up and run with. If you look at the run of food films of different food cultures, that's essentially what it is. You're talking about food, of a particular kind of food, and sort of presenting it to the larger world.
Interesting. And so it's funny because sometimes I think that when people are asking what American cuisine is, which is a question the James Beard Foundation poses or posits an answer to all the time, I always often say that I don't know what American cuisine is, but the American style of eating has been more pervasive, the type of restaurant, the right. eating on the go. It's interesting to hear that from your perspective, the French style of talking about or integrating food into sort of a form of cultural literacy is really
now,
the legacy.
Now, it is also true that the informalization, which you're talking about in America, you also see it in France to a lesser degree, but you do see it.
Sure.
See it in France. That informalization, if you can see, say, beginning in the Renaissance, we have table settings and elaborate sequence of service and so forth. All of those strict cultural forms are now sort of going by the wayside in a lot of places. And that informalization, whether it's dress, what people wear, and your informal background, but then the emphasis is even more on the individual food, not part of a culinary tradition, but individual food, what I call haute food,
okay.
as opposed to haute cuisine, which is a tradition.
So a little bit more about haute food. I love that idea. What is...
If you take cuisine as a repertory of works, dishes, and whatnot that goes together, Italian cuisine or whatever, in other words, you serve something, it's part of a larger tradition. Haute food is trying to find the fanciest, the most unusual, the most exotic presentation of a dish that you can think of. It's sort of disconnected from any tradition. What it's connected to is the chef.
Right.
It's the chef's image. This is what I want you to have. It's not French cuisine. It's not Italian. It's not American style. It's haute, my haute food.
That's such a great phrase. I may have to adopt that. We do have a question from a listener, which speaks a little bit to something we were talking about at the beginning of the show, and it is considering the current craze of media that we're in and the impact that has had on the way we eat, this listener asks, are there other times in history when, from a sociological perspective, there was such an important external influences on food and the way we eat? And I'm thinking actually of your work in the explosion of the food press and cookbooks, explosion after the revolution, let's say, or Grimaud de la Reynière and Briat Savarin.
No, I think that's absolutely true. You've got the same notion of reaching out to a broader audience. post-revolutionary France, you've got the urbanization, so people are concentrated in Paris, and so someone like Grimaud Lacanière tells people where these are the best places to buy things, and this is how you should do this and that and the other thing. So reaching out to different audiences, and you know, now it's, you know, it's exponentially broader because of television and films and so forth, but it's the same process.
And one of the things surprising to me when I went back and actually read some of those original Almanach des Gourmands that, Renier produced was even the tone was familiar and contemporary, familial, I would say. Yeah. It reminded me of New York Magazine's reviews where it's like, oh, so-and-so is there and you should eat the, I don't know, the foie gras. It's just, they were, felt very contemporary to read them even today.
Well, he was the first really gastronomic journalist and, you know, the model keeps, still works.
Indeed. I know that academics and probably especially sociologists do not like to predict the future, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Where do you think, because only it feels like we're in such a transitional period now, because there is this frenzy, and at some point I suspect some things will settle down and sift through American culture. Where do you think we're going with this vast interest? Do you think food's getting better? Do you think we're going to get nearer to some form of cultural value to food the way they are in France? What do you think's happening? I mean, you happen to be a lover of food, I should have said at the beginning, too, and restaurants and well-eaten.
Well, you also have to think that, say, if we're just talking about the United States, you know, this is a big country. There are a lot of places out there where there aren't foodies of any sort. There's barely food half the time, where people have to drive 50-odd miles to go to a supermarket. There are still a number of places there that, in New York, we have a New York perspective with all this interest and change and new restaurants and new shops and so forth. But there are places and not so far from here where that cannot sustain a really good restaurant. I think of the place I live upstate. We've had three restaurants close in the past year.
Right.
Three, quote, nice, good, whatever restaurant.
And then there's the economic diversity, the cultural...
Then a lot of people are also... part of the interest in food has to do with sustainability and more general issues of that nature. And then there are the health issues. And it's a question of how much that comes together. I think the discourses or the talk on each of those are going to stay separate or become more separate, I think, which is... too bad, because partially in terms of specialization, there's just so much being done and written that you can't really do it all the way you could, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago.
Right. And one of the things that really, I think, brings home how entrenched an appreciation and a value of food is in other cultures, in Italy particularly, or France, is how it, at every level, it's important. It's not just a game or an interest of the rich, let's say, or even just talked about that way, that it's almost at the level of a human right or need.
Right.
And we're a long way from that, perhaps, in our appreciation of food. Excuse me. I think now's a good time, since we're at the end of the show, to apologize for the way that we sound, but to thank you for slogging through and to thank you for joining us. It's always an honor and a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you.
And thank you for the invitation.
And next week, we will be talking on Taste Matters with Alan Salkin, as I mentioned, who's the author, most recently, of From Scratch, a biography of the Food Network, or a history of the Food Network. And I would encourage you to pick it up. I will admit that I was reluctant to take it off my desk and to flip through it, and then I could not put the thing down. You really get to see recent history as it was made. If you've been listening or paying attention to food for the last 20 years, you will recognize it all, and you'll see a real window into TV and the culture that we've just been talking about, how food talk really has exploded and why, and some of the decisions that have led to it. So that's your homework for the next week and in preparation for next week's show. In the meantime, why don't you have a meal, think about it, talk about it, and let's create our own form of oat food and food speak while we cough away here at Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.